mean that you have to redesign the whole thing again from scratch, which is, you know, complete waste of time and money for a lot of people. So
hello and welcome to episode 61 of the MedTech Podcast. You join me, your host, Karandeep Singh Badwell. And in this episode, we have Nicola Thorne, CEO and founder of Tento Plus, a company that helps companies generate technical documentation that is audit ready. Nicola is an expert in technical compliance for medical devices, working across FDA, UKCA, and CE market approvals for digital health tech products, and completed a PhD in mathematics at the University of Reading. As well as founding Tento Plus, Nicola is CEO of A&D Technology, an award-winning product development consultancy. She has worked in product development in electronics, software, machine learning, and at Tech for Good for over 10 years. In this episode, we explore the application of generative AI tools in software development, examining their advantages for content creation and emphasizing the crucial need to verify their outputs. We also shed light on the entrepreneurial pursuits of individuals within the NHS, discussing the underlying reasons and the existing programs supporting this transition. Additionally, we delve into the risks associated with retrospectively documenting design controls, providing insights into the potential pitfalls of such practices. Welcome to the show, Nicola. How are you today?
Yeah, very well, thank you, Karandeep. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. So making your software medical device compliant can be quite confusing and is often a very lengthy process. What would you say is the most efficient way of going about this?
So I think software is slightly different, I guess, than some other medical devices, where particularly in the electronics, so if you have sort of physical devices, in that software itself can be very complicated. There can be a lot of it and not always as deterministic as other devices. So I think the way to make it less complicated is to plan properly and to think about what you're going to measure your performance of the software by an early stage. So it's definitely about thinking in the way that you're going to verify the software and what performance parameters are going to be key for your particular software. I think one of the other things is always about software organization as well. So it's very much about thinking how you're going to manage your software, which is quite different in some ways to just one drawing or one mechanical design. There's lots of parts of it. I've seen people have, you know, thousands of source files, which if you imagine you're trying to make a traceability of that, understand how that functions and what parts of the software system perform certain key criteria, that can be very challenging. So making sure that you have a handle on that early is really, really key. Yeah. And I think there are a lot of tools for that as well. I don't know if that's something that you've seen, but trying to get the right tools, you know, at the start to make sure that you're managing that process can be very, very helpful and time saving.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, because trying to do things in retrospective, and we've had this conversation in the past, it's kind of like you have to do it all over again. So do it first properly. Otherwise, you're just kind of wasting your time with a lot of these things.
Yeah, exactly. Again, and you find, you know, one of the things that is important is about documenting this. And this is true for any medical device, right? It's about documenting the important design decisions that you made throughout the design process. So understanding that retrospectively is actually one of the hardest things to do, particularly if you have a big team of people. You know, it's okay maybe if it's one person doing the software, but what if they leave? You know, you lose a lot of that information. And if it hasn't been documented early, that can, you know, that can basically mean that you have to redesign the whole thing again from scratch, which is, you know, complete waste of time and money for a lot of people. So yeah, definitely the earlier the better.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And that's a good point that you bring up. The dynamic of startup companies, people always changing jobs or leaving. So sometimes you don't know why somebody made a change in a software, whereas if you had a process in place, it would be documented why that change was even made.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's, you know, comparing it to other industries. I was talking to someone recently who was an architect, actually, and it was, we were talking about that issue that they have, that someone will do an architectural design and put a window somewhere, right? And then another person or the builder comes along and now they have to make it. And if that design decision isn't documented well, then you have really no idea why that's been, you know, why that's been chosen. So I think it's a a very similar thing in the medical field, is that, you know, you've got auditors coming in looking at those design decisions and making approval decisions, you know, for your market submission on those key elements. And if you don't have that clearly documented and justified, that's the thing that can cause the real headache. I think people often think that, particularly in startup attitudes, that, you know, rightly so, they're trying to skim, well, not skim, but reduce costs and time to market. But at sometimes at the detriment of things that are going to take a lot longer in, you know, down the line. So it's a balancing act for sure, particularly for startups. Yeah.
So following on from that, a process of which early startups often don't realise is the design control process. And again, like we were discussing earlier, they try to do that retrospectively come submission time. So for the listeners today who maybe don't know what this is, what are design controls and why is it important that you do it properly and early on?
Yeah, so design controls is, as it says on the tin really, it's a process by which you control the design of your medical device. So that takes into account several things, but starting mainly with understanding what the device is meant to do and clearly documenting that. So that will be within your intended use statement and also documenting use specifications and user needs. Then it moves on to, okay, well, I've got what my device is meant to do. I know who it's for and what problems it's solving. So therefore, how do I go about creating that device in a controlled manner so that I know that I'm following the correct guidance and procedures? So that falls under sort of standard operating processes and creating and documenting plans. So those are your design plans, really. Then you have things that follow on from those two things, right? So I know what I want to do and I know how I'm going to do it, but you might need to take input from other places, and particularly in the medical world, obviously that's to do with risk controls, but there might be clinical input that you also want to do, usability things, and then commercial drivers as well for your device. So those are what's called design inputs. And those three things, really, your user needs, your design plans, and your design inputs all go into then how you create your device. And what you get out of the end of that process is your design outputs. So that's things like your source files, any mechanical drawings, the actual prototypes, things like that. At the end of that, you're meant to sort of verify and validate what you get out against what you said you wanted to make. So that process is the V&V of the device, verification and validation. And really, you should be reviewing across each of those stages that I've just mentioned against what it is that, you know, that the requirements are. So in your design input, say, you would have your software specification, where you'd be writing exactly what your software needs to do. In your user needs, you would be writing your use requirements. And therefore, you, when you get to your design outputs, you go back and check that what you've actually made firstly works and verifying it, but also validating it against those requirements that you said at the start. And that's really the design control process. Obviously, after that, you then go on to a clinical evaluation of checking that it does clinically what it says and provides a kind of clinical benefit to the user. But that's less about the design of the device and more about the clinical side. So there's that kind of design transfer, I suppose, between the design control and your design outputs into a clinical evaluation. I guess why it's important to do it early and to do it properly is, as we just said, documenting is everything in medical compliance. So documenting all of your design decisions, documenting traceability between your requirements that you have in your design inputs and your design outputs that actually implement those requirements. If you imagine that you have, you know, I don't know, 1,000 source files in your software, trying to map out which ones do which functions, which ones implement certain requirements or certain features, that's very hard to do retrospectively. If you're going along and doing the coding and your engineers are engaged in the design control process, then that's a lot easier for them to manage as they're going through the code. It's very similar to, you know, software engineers will know this, that commenting code as you're going along is far easier than going back and understanding someone else's code and going through and making comments. So the earlier that you do it, the better it is. That being said, obviously, it can be a bit overwhelming. There's a lot of it. If you're not, you know, if you're not totally a regulatory compliance expert yourself, reading the standards, they can be quite overwhelming. So I think that there are lots of tools like podcasts, like this podcast, that help you kind of understand that. And there is, I'd say, a way to start that process without necessarily having to break the bank at the start. So it's a case of finding the right tools, finding some sort of the right people and the right information, and just starting that process, you know, just documenting certain things, writing a requirements, even if it's just in Excel, you know, or a Word document, just write down whatever's in your head, a list of requirements, and then at least you've got a starting point. I think often people think of compliance as like this thing that you do at the end, or like my device is compliant. You know, they think, well, my design is done, now I can go and like verify my compliance or whatever. And actually what the regulators will be looking for is that a controlled process throughout the way that you've made that device. So therefore you really need to be documenting that early, but it is a journey. So this is all iterative, you know, your requirements might change. So it doesn't have to be kind of perfect from the start. Obviously you want to have a compliant process, but these types of things are meant to be living documents, you know, that taking inputs all the time. So I think, you know, not having a view where you can think, okay, well, I'm just going to get going with my compliance early, and yes, I might need to tweak it, and I might need to change my standard operating processes, or I might need to change my requirements document. That's all fine, but you just need to make a start early on.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. So I suppose a follow-on question from that is, not every single change that you make requires the full design control process, i.e. let's just say you're changing something like font, background, etc. At what point do you decide whether something is worth going through the design control process or not?
So that's all normally around risk. So risk to the patient. So, or risk of causing harm. So if there's a change really to something that is clinical, I'd say, so something that has a clinical effect, then that needs to be well controlled. If there is something that changes, say, the usability of the device and might invalidate, say, a user study that you've done. So you've made an assumption that let's take an example that you said of the font. So if the font is a certain size and that was tested in your user study and you're changing that, then you would need to go and firstly risk assess that change. And then if it's deemed that it could have a risk or invalidate, you know, the findings that you had from your user study, then that would need to go through the design control process again. If it's something like a small typo, then you can, you know, that's actually fixing the thing. It doesn't necessarily need to go through that whole design control process again. So it's really about the impact that it's going to have on the usability and the clinical effectiveness of the device. Other areas where there's possibly more confusion, particularly with software, is when you're changing things like algorithms. So generally, you know, regulators or whoever might be auditing you would normally want to know about any changes to algorithms, partly just because they can be a bit, you know, you can make a small change and actually it be quite a big change in the end without you realizing. So they always tend to, you know, want to review that. Other things that don't normally fall under change control as much is things where you're changing, say, the design of a manufacturing process or part of that, because it's not changing the design of the medical device, that falls under kind of another type of change, I guess, away from the design controls. So it's really risk driven and the effect that it's going to have on the usability and the clinical effectiveness and safety, you know, of the device.
So a term that you mentioned earlier, of course, that we can start using generative AI tools to help assist us with the development process. What would you say are the benefits and also the limitations of this technology? Where are some cases where maybe you shouldn't use this type of tools?
Yeah, I think, you know, AI is a big hot topic word, isn't it? So it's there's a lot of uses in medical devices. And actually, we've just launched a Tento Plus generative AI tool for medical compliance. And there are definite benefits to it. So I think if I start with those and then I'll go to the when you shouldn't use it. But the real helpful parts of it is, I think, twofold. One is, as most generative AI is, it's content creation. So it's quick content creation. So if you're an SME or a startup and you're looking for a way, you know, you're trying to manage seven different things at once and keeps all these plates spinning, it's a case of, you know, how do I get a sort of first initial compliance setup quickly. And generative AI is very useful for that because it can allow you to type, or out, or anyway, can allow you to type in a device description, and it will generate for you things for you to consider. So it will say, okay, you're creating a heart tracker, or, you know, something like that. And, you know, you'll describe the function, the users, how the software has been made, say how the electronics has been designed. And then it will give you a list of things that says, okay, you need to think about your labeling, you need to think about your software requirements, you need to think about your electrical safety, and so on and so on. So it has a, you know, it's been trained to know certain things about medical compliance to get you some of the way to creating that content. Part of that is also learning. So it will suggest things to you that you might not have thought about yourself. So often, depending on who is, say, dealing with the compliance in the company, particularly if you don't have a quality, you know, full-time quality person, you might forget things like that you need to think about your labeling. And particularly in software, often people don't think about the fact that software actually has to be labeled, because it's not a physical thing, but you do need to have a software label. So it would then prompt you to think about those types of things and say, you know, have you thought about how you're going to verify this particular requirement or that requirement? So it really gives you a starting point to move forward from when you're starting out that journey. I think the limitations of it is obviously it's not a regulatory consultant. It doesn't claim to be. Generative AI is, you know, it's a patent-based machine learning algorithm. So it's, whilst it's very good, it's not actually understanding the content. It's just predicting the next bit of text. So it's a very, very good sort of predictive text machine, if anything. So in that sense, you really don't want to be relying on it and taking what it says as the complete truth. But that's true, you know, for most machine learning algorithms. So I think it's a case of, yeah, and the benefit, it's saying it can get me some way up the curve. It can, you know, it can help me understand what I need to do and even format things for me and create documentation. But you definitely need to review it. And you need to take that review seriously. Don't rely on it, because it's, you know, it's there and it's generating content that might not be quite right for your device. It might sound right, but it might not be exactly, you know, how your device works or exactly your intended user population, that type of thing. So it's definitely important to understand that and to either review it yourself or to seek someone who's got that quality and compliance knowledge to actually then go through what it is that you've managed to make from that.
So following on from that, you're currently CEO of Tenso, a company who has an AI platform to help with compliance. How exactly does that software platform work?
Yeah, so it's an online tool, browser-based, so you could just go on and sign up at tensoplus.com. And it's really to manage the design control aspect of creating a medical device. So it will generate parts of a compliant design history or technical file for you. So what you do is you go on and you give your device description. So you would give it some details about what the device does, how it's been made, and then you press various buttons on screen, and it will create you things like your requirements. So it will come up with, say, software requirements for you, electrical requirements, and it would generate some of that content for you. As I said, you obviously need to review and make sure that it's applicable to your device, but it will at least give you a starting point for that. It will also then look at your testing side, so the verification of your design outputs. So it will write you a test plan. It won't write the details of the test protocol, because that's too specific to your device, and you would want to have to think about the way in which you were going to verify and validate the device that you'd made. But it will generate a test plan for you and say you need to check the software performance, you need to check electrical safety, you need to do a drop test on it, those types of things. So it would then generate that for you. And then you could take that forward into, okay, well, these are some of the types of things that we need to think about, and really kind of get you thinking about what it is that you're going to verify and validate. And the other thing that it does is also help you with the traceability. So as I said earlier, when you're detailing your requirements and your design inputs, you have to relate that to your design outputs and the way that you've tested that. So it's a very simple example. Say you had a thermometer and it needed to take a temperature. So that was one requirement. You would then have a design output that would be the actual thermometer, and then you would need to test that. So through that traceability, you'd have to have a requirement ID number that would relate to, say, the drawing or the mechanical design or the actual sort of prototype of that thermometer. And then you would have to reference that onwards to a test record number to show that you've got complete traceability from your starting requirement to your testing and your validation. And so our generative AI tool in Tento Plus can also help you with that. So it will then specify, take your design requirements and your design outputs and try and map them based on a description that you give. And again, that can be a huge time saving, particularly in the world of software where you're trying to map, say, you know, hundreds or thousands of files and functionality for a large system. So it's specific. The tool is specifically aimed for startups and SMEs and people who, you know, want to get started on that compliance journey, want to do it early, don't necessarily quite have the resources to, say, have a full-time regulatory expert on board to help them with that, and really a tool to manage it that doesn't require you to have a quality administrator going through all of that stuff as well. So it's really aimed at a very lean and agile process for doing your medical compliance alongside your development. And then at the end, what you get out, there's a nice big download button and you get part of your design history file. So you can output everything, you know, all of your test records, all of your requirements documents in a format that's, you know, we've reviewed and auditors have reviewed and said is, you know, good to go in your design history file.
So a conversation we've had in the past is that we talked about how a lot of clinical people working within the NHS are going into entrepreneurship for the purposes of trying to improve the NHS. From your own experience as an entrepreneur, what would you say are the reasons why somebody should maybe not consider this path?
Should not consider the path. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there are several reasons, really. I think it's because you're doing it alongside your general role in the NHS normally. So I'm a mentor on the NHS Clinical Entrepreneur Scheme and come across some amazing people who have brilliant ideas. And really, they're either thinking that they want to stay in the NHS, but they just have a good idea and would love to see this technology available to them in the hospital or the clinic that they're in. Or someone is thinking actually that they're more of an entrepreneur and want to kind of, you know, create a startup themselves and move away slightly from working in the NHS. I think either one of those things, it's like any startup, you know, you've really got to have the time to be able to give it in some ways, and that's a real challenge for people. So using, you know, the right tools or trying to make as many connections as you can, and the NHS Clinical Entrepreneur Program, that's what it's all about. It's really trying to find people that can help you accelerate along that way. Otherwise it can be quite time consuming, and often, you know, people get a bit frustrated or disheartened because it's not moving as quickly as they would like. So I think, you know, that's definitely one of the struggles that people don't want, you know, that they don't want to do that. I think the other thing is there's so many people have so many great ideas, but funding in particular is a real challenge. And even small amounts of funding can be quite hard to obtain. So it's then how much do you want to invest yourself? Is that just through time, or is that also through any sort of personal funding that you want to give to the project? And that again can be quite challenging for a lot of people working in the NHS. So there's definitely some reasons why they, you know, don't want to embark on that journey. But I think if you do, and I think, you know, the Clinical Entrepreneur Scheme is free. So that is, you know, it's a great environment to find out maybe actually whether that is a journey for you to even embark on at the start. So it's, you know, and some of them, you know, do become successful products, and they have affected, you know, patients in the NHS directly. But it is, you know, it's not a it's not a short journey. It's like any startup, right? I'm sure that you see this. It's people often think that they're quite near the end, and actually they're just at the start. And so it is a it can be a very long journey. Yeah.
So what is it that convinced you to go into entrepreneurship for yourself? What was the enlightening moment for you?
Yeah, I think for me, it's a bit of freedom. I'm quite a creative person, so I quite like having, you know, creative ideas and trying to sort of make them come to life. I think that's partly why I'm quite excited by Tento, because part of the possibility of that is to quicken that compliance and take the burden off people at a starting point to get a certain way through that compliance journey. And so that for me is part of the motivation why I like seeing ideas. I like part of my job is that I get to talk to so many people about, you know, and you must find this as well, so many interesting devices that come onto the market or that people have ideas for. And that's, you know, that's really nice to see. So I think in that sense, there's a creative freedom that you get with entrepreneurship that you maybe don't get in other places. And just having autonomy, you know, you could decide that this sounds like a good path for your idea, or you don't like that idea. And that can be quite a personal decision, actually, or it can be very business driven. So I think there's a certain level of autonomy that you get when you have that. And I think, you know, I've always been a bit of a person who likes to have control, if I could say, if I can not give myself a character assassination too much. But, you know, you get a lot of control and responsibility about what you do, which is, you know, which is great. And I personally quite like that for myself.
So what's the future looking for like on you, Nicola, at the moment? Are you working on something else, or are you just currently working with Tento and the other projects you have?
Yeah, so the future's, you know, the immediate future is for Tento Plus. So we launched back in June. We're looking for more users. We have users signed up, which is great, but obviously we want to grow our user base, and that's really the focus for the short term. I also work at a company called And Technology Research, and we're a design and development consultancy. So as part of my work, I also get to work still as a software engineer sometimes, or a system architect, on developing those projects for our customers. And so that's still part of my work, and I really enjoy that as well. I think one of the things that I would also, you know, like to do in the future is think about how we can grow Tento Plus just away from being a tool, you know, that helps people for design controls, but also take that into other areas of compliance as well. So really to do with like the you know, the clinical aspects, there's production elements of controlling your device as well, so things like your device master record. So really expanding, I guess, what Tento Plus can offer someone, rather than it just being at the stage of design controls, but thinking about risk management, clinical trials, clinical evaluation. So there's lots of places for it to go. I have to say, I'm not a clinical expert myself. I'm a software engineer, a mathematician by training. So definitely excited to kind of talk to more people about how something like Tento Plus and generative AI could even help in that space as well. It's really exciting.
So working with multiple companies and different projects, and also being quite active, I know you do a lot of talks online and offline as well. This clearly keeps you quite busy, but what are you getting up to outside of work in the small amount of free time that you have?
I quite like traveling. I like when I can have the time to go abroad, and I'm really into squash as well, and then cycling. So I do a lot of cycling around, cycling holidays, and playing a lot of sport is mainly my thing. Trying to, you know, I have mainly a desk driven job, so it's nice to kind of get out and stretch the legs and get my heart rate up away from clinical compliance and technology development. But it's the weather's turning a bit now though for the outdoor cycling. I'm definitely a fair weather cyclist, so I'll be back on the indoor squash court, I think, for me at the moment.
So it's been a pleasure having you on the show today. What one piece of advice would you be leaving the listeners with?
Yeah, I think if you're thinking about entrepreneurship and medical devices and how you can affect it, I think just start, I think would be my advice. You know, it's overwhelming. It is a long journey, but you'll find lots of things out. There's lots of help about, you know, it's a very welcoming industry. Most people I meet just want to improve, you know, patient outcomes. There's lots of free resources, lots of great people, lots of schemes and accelerators and things to access. So I think whilst it can be overwhelming, it can be a daunting thing. You've got this sort of huge mountain in front of you to climb. You know, actually just making a start and just thinking about the very next step that you've got to do. It's good to have an end goal of your like dream and vision. But what is it can I do this week or today? Or even if, you know, you're working full time and you're doing this kind of in the background of your normal job, is okay, what can I complete in the next 6 months? What can I complete in the next month? You know, so having those next sort of smaller goals that are tangible, and you'll find along the way that you get knocked off course by something, or, you know, you find out that there's this whole other avenue or even other industry that your product might work in. Then, you know, you find these things out on the journey. You don't need to know everything from the start. So I think just get started, just get stuck in, and it is an enjoyable process.
Thank you very much for your time, Nicola.
Thank you very much, Kerendy. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to episode 61 of the MedTech Podcast. If you have not already done so, please subscribe. If you wish to learn more about Nicola, you can connect with her online or visit her company websites, the links of which are provided in the description. If there are any particular topics or guests you'd like for me to have on the show in future, then feel free to reach out.